Hello, everybody, and welcome to Elmtown episode 27. Today we're flipping the tables and we've got a spotlight on Elmtown and its host itself. Welcome to Elmtown, Murphy.
Thank you very much.
But first, to our sponsors, of course, Day One, a beautiful journaling and live archiving app currently available on Mac and iOS and Android, coming soon to other platforms. You should definitely check it out. I actually purchased Day One recently and have been starting to journal, thanks to Murphy's encouragement via Twitter.
I love it.
So that's been very, very cool. I'm finding that very interesting. Our second sponsor, Daily Drip. Daily Drip makes keeping up to date on programming skills easy. Daily Drip will save you a ton of time by providing quality lessons and resources for you right off the bat. Some topics include Elixir, Crystal, React Native, Go, HTML, and of course, Elm. So learn faster and more efficiently with Daily Drip and be a better developer. Every weekday, you'll get a short video, about 5 minutes, delivered into your inbox, and you can sign up at www.dailydrip.com using the coupon code ELMTOWN-2018, and you'll get a 14-day free trial, so definitely check that out. And our last sponsor, but not least, of course, is Ellie. Ellie is our bandwidth sponsor. Ellie is an Elm live editor. Great for trying out small examples in Elm, which most of you already know and love, so thanks to Ellie for that. And finally, a big thank you. This episode, as always, is produced by Fergus Micklejohn, and we thank him for his time and patience editing our mistakes.
Thanks, Ferg.
So, as you can probably tell, I'm not Murphy. I'm Mario. But Murphy is Murphy.
I'm still here.
Say hello again, Murphy.
I'm still here. I'm always here.
So, thanks to Murphy for taking a break from being on the show to being on the show even more intensely. So we're, just to be clear, maybe for everybody listening in, Murphy didn't ask to be on his own show. I pitched the idea to him, so it's not like Murphy loves Murphy. I mean, we love Murphy, and we hope Murphy loves himself in a healthy, non-obsessive way. But I thought it would be really awesome to get to know our fearless Elmtown host a little better.
Well, I feel flattered, too, so thank you. I appreciate it.
No, awesome. I'm totally excited. So let's dive in. Murphy, tell us, where are you from?
Well, that's a great question. I'm from Utah in the United States of America, a little state in the western United States above California. For those who are trying to, California is probably a more popular state. So there's a nice little tech center in Utah that I happen to be born into, basically. So I was born in Provo and raised there. I've lived there my whole life, except for a few years that I spent elsewhere.
You're going to have to excuse my ignorance. Is it Salt Lake City that's the capital of Utah?
Yeah, that's right. And Salt Lake is about 45 minutes north by car of where I live. So, yeah.
Oh,
well, maybe
very cool.
Like half an hour. But, yeah, that's right. That's not ignorance. That is excellent knowledge that you would know that.
Awesome. And so you've grown up in Utah. And I understand you have family, you have some children?
Oh, yeah, yes. So do you want to hear, like, the fast version of Murphy growing up? Is that...
Oh, totally. That'd be awesome.
Right. Okay, cool. So it's kind of a twisty-turn story, but I was born in Provo, raised there, and I was homeschooled for all of elementary school, for part-time during junior high. And so that's the way that the U.S. school system works, is there's elementary school, and then at about... I'm having a hard time remembering now. I think 12 years old. There are a couple years of junior high, at least in Utah, and then there are 4 years after that of high school. So I was homeschooled for all of elementary school, half of junior high, and then for a couple of subjects as well during high school. So I never took math at public school besides physics, you know, just non-standard math stuff. So I did math at home. I did English. My mom was an English teacher in high school, meaning she taught high school English, and then that was before she had kids. So I got a nice education at home, which I really appreciated. And my parents met at Brigham Young University and never left Utah because they loved it there and stayed. And that's the school that I loved as well. And it's somewhat of a challenge to get into BYU academically. And so my graduation test from homeschool was, can you get into BYU? And so that was always the threat that my mom threw at me when I didn't want to do my homework, because she said, oh, you're not going to get into BYU. And so I had to buckle down. And the reason that that's important, why I bring that up, is because I did get into BYU and I started going to BYU. But for years before that, probably since I was about 9 years old, I had been totally fascinated with computers and technology, and to some extent, web stuff. I learned HTML as part of homeschool. and things, but also especially animation software, 3D animation software, just loved it. I would spend all my time with it. I would sit with the manuals for the software and I would just like read through. I wouldn't actually read how to do stuff. I would mostly flip through and daydream. But from an early age, I learned how to love animation and love the technology involved. And so I just happened to grow up next to BYU, which is one of the best schools in the United States and possibly the world for getting into the animation industry. And so the funny part there is I actually, my first year at BYU, my parents, they were planning on helping pay for school or paying for tuition. And they said, mm-hmm. we won't pay for your tuition unless you're an engineer because we have enough artists in this family already. My dad and mom were musicians. My dad owns a recording studio. And so he was a self-made audio engineer. And, my brother does video production and my sister does music and the other sister does art. So we were a very liberal arts family and they said, we need someone to make money. And so they said, you gotta be a mechanical engineer. And I kind of resigned myself to that. And, until one day my mom came into my room and said, if you're going to get into the animation program, you better learn how to draw. And she like gave me some art books. And I said, well, does that mean that I can be an animation major? And she said, like, you better practice drawing. And so, so I did a bunch of practicing.
It's not a yes, but it's not a no.
Yeah, that's right. They had talked about it and decided that they would let me pursue that passion, which was, I'm forever grateful to them for that. And the funny part is I went to BYU and I started doing all the work to get into the animation program, which was very competitive at the time. I say at the time, it's way more competitive now, but even then it was competitive. And I ended up getting into the program, but had nothing to do with my art skills because I had a friend who knew someone in the program that said, hey, the senior project that's being worked on right now is they really need some help on the senior project because part of the problem at BYU is that the animation program was good enough that the seniors would get hired by studios before they were done with their senior project. And there was, right. It's all like one big senior project. A lot of schools have seniors do their own little projects. This was everyone, the whole senior class is making a movie together, a short film. And so all these seniors had left, they were short staffed and I knew how to do stuff. So I went in and started spending, 40 to 60 hours a week, I believe, something like that, in there working on, and just loving, I was in heaven working on those projects. And so when it came time to apply to get into the program, I applied, and I had been doing all this work on getting my art skills up to snuff, and they let me in, and I was excited about that. And then I found out afterward from the professors, they were like, yeah, we didn't open your portfolio because we knew we wanted you in because of the work you'd been doing on the computers, on the tech stuff. And I was pretty sad because I had spent so much work trying to become an acceptable artist. And so I pretty much dropped the art after that. Like I was like, if no one's going to care about my art anyway, then I'm not going to put that much work into it. So
in the end, your parents were onto something, perhaps.
That's right. I did end up being an engineer despite the plan, just a different kind of engineer. So that was, I guess I'm going a little too long with the story, but I'll wrap it up here. Point is, I spent a lot of time and sweat in that animation lab and doing programming for animation, rendering, things like that. And Pixar Animation Studios noticed, and they said, hey, are you interested in coming to do an internship? And I said, nope, because I've got to go serve a mission, a service and preaching mission for my church, which is I'm LDS, which is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And it's regular for young men and women to go when they're about 18 to 21, to go out and serve a mission where we just try to help people like learn to be happy. And we try to provide service and try to, share our beliefs. And that's a 2-year thing that we do. It's shorter for young women, but, for longer for young men. And that's something that it's something that no one's paid for. It's, you pay for yourself or find help paying for it. So it's a service opportunity. And that was so important to me that I said no to Pixar and I went ahead and did that and trusted that I would be able to pick things up on the backside once I came home. And that's what happened. I came back things were still basically how they had been before, and I was still good at it. So Pixar said, hey, we're still interested. And I said, great, I'll come now. And so I went and did I worked on Cars 2, if you've seen that movie, which is probably the least the least popular Pixar film. So I got to work on that one. But I loved it anyway. It was a great experience. So all of this to say, not a whole lot of my background has been in actual programming. I mean, that's where I learned programming. I learned like Python and PHP, et cetera, at school. I came back and tried to be a CS major at that point because I was having a great time programming at Pixar. And I said, wow, I really am resonating with this. Maybe I'll switch from animation to computer science. And so I did that. I came back. And that happened to also be the semester that I got married. So I came back from Pixar, got married, and did my next semester of school having switched to computer science, and worked really hard and got a 4.0 that semester, which means all A's, which is all the top grades. But that was like the best semester I ever had in college. I mean, never got better than that. Only went downhill because that was when I had like all CS classes and no kids. And so it was easy to focus on what I was doing. But after that, you know, like, don't tell anyone I got a C in biology. It was pretty bad. C minus or something, but I passed, right? So I finished school and did eventually get my degree, which I started working during school. I did a fellowship in entrepreneurship. I mean, there's a lot of details here, but had my first kid during school, and then finished up, and by the way, went back to do a master's, started a master's degree, and then had my second kid. So I still, there's never been a time when I've had a baby and hadn't had to study right during my paternity leave. So that's a goal for next baby.
On hard mode.
Yeah, that's right. I've decided to level down a little bit. So next baby that comes along, no school.
Yeah, right. And what was your master's in?
My master's, I was doing a master's at Georgia Tech in computer science. So here's a whole nother can of worms, but I did end up deciding that, that's not the path I wanted to go down, just for the sake of my career and how things have been going there. I ended up deciding to withdraw, not because Georgia Tech isn't awesome, but just because of, you know, life circumstances and stuff. So I am school free now and settled with a bachelor's degree only. So
wow.
There's like
Wonderful.
The growing
that's
up. A, yeah.
Wow, that's a hell of a history. That's really, really cool. It's, okay, so quite a lot of diversity. I think maybe for a lot of people in programming, you've done things quite differently. So the homeschooling, then going down the animation stream, kind of realizing that you could do this engineering stuff, and you've got an interest in the computing side, eventually throwing away but just setting it to the side, the animation, and honing in on the programming stuff, and inevitably getting to work for Pixar anyway. That's very, very cool. So throughout this kind of journey, and all this stuff's happening, and you married and kids, and you also you didn't tell us where you went away for your mission trip.
Oh, that's right.
Was that within the States or overseas?
Thanks for asking. That was Buenos Aires, Argentina. And so I learned to speak Spanish there. So I still try to keep that up. So if you're listening to the show and want to chat and help me practice my Spanish, I'm more than happy to do that.
Very cool. And I guess we should probably come to the Elm narrative. How did Elm fit into this crazy, vibrant timeline of yours?
That's a great question. So let's go back to end of school. So here's what's interesting. And life takes funny turns. I've been talking to my wife a lot about this lately, but up until marriage and just after, Pixar has kind of always been my thing. Like, that's kind of where I knew I was going to go and wanted to be. And like, I ate, slept, and drank animation. And I was like, well, of course I'm going to go be someone who works at Pixar. And then the internship came and I was like, yeah, I mean, this is exactly what I'm doing. And I will do this always. But things change. And I came back to school and got married. And I applied to Pixar a couple more times and didn't hear back, which I was surprised by. And so I started looking for other opportunities. So this is just one of those things where, like, life kind of threw me a curveball because I didn't know at that point what I was going to do next, because I was like, well, I'll get back to Pixar eventually, in when they have the right role open up, but what do I do in the meantime? And it's been about 7 years since then, so that's more time than I thought it would be, certainly. And I mean, I may end up applying there again, I don't know, so we'll see how life works out. But it has been interesting, certainly, to fill up to delightfully fill up the past 7 years with a plan that I hadn't seen as a college student or as a child, even before that. But I looked for jobs locally while I was in school. I was supposed to get an internship because I was part of a fellowship doing entrepreneurial things, and said, well, get an internship for the summer. So I applied with a couple places, and there was a local company doing distributed data storage and doing Python that had a job for a Python web programmer. And I had been doing tons of Python for animation because that's a popular language in that domain. And so I contacted them and said, hey, may I please have an internship? And they said, no, but you can have a job. And I said, well, okay, yeah, that sounds great. So started my first full-time job there and kind of did the dance of working there and finishing school at the same time. And that's where I first started to get into actual web programming. And that's where I did like Python and Flask, and we were using a Postgres database, and I was like, SQL, I've never done anything like this really before other than PHP MyAdmin for my home projects in WordPress. And there also learned Angular, started to get into the JavaScript world, and I was stuck with that company through an acquisition, so they got acquired and worked for the acquiring company for a while, and then it was time to shake things up again after about, I think it was like a year and 9 months, and then I started to look around. And then I saw an opportunity in a new company that was opening up, another startup that was taking on the ed tech world. So there's the company I went to next was called Kuali, and they were really aiming to make curriculum management and products to help students track their schools, and well, really to help schools administer their work with students and with teachers. So that was a really cool opportunity. I love education, so I was glad to help out there, and I was one of the first few people on board, and so we really got to lay the foundation, and I really got to learn how much I didn't know while I was there. I mean, so far for me, my career has been time after time of realizing that I know nothing. And it just never gets better. I mean, I know some things, and then I get hit with another thing I know nothing about. So I don't know. Has that been your experience too, Mario?
I mean, that's, I'd say definitely yes, but it's not the the most optimistic of career pitches to prospective engineers.
That's true.
Come and be an engineer and continually feel like everything you've learned is nothing.
That's a great point. Actually, this is a really interesting interlude, if you don't mind. I was listening to a book on World War II, and there was a commander or a general. Maybe it was a general? Not a general. There was a high-up person in the U.S. Army who got...
Somebody in charge.
That's right. Who got stuck in a prison camp for like 6 years and really was able to do amazing things for the people that... for the other soldiers that were there with him in this horrible camp where they were treated horribly. And they made it through. And he talked about how they said... And I apologize if I've said this on the podcast before, but this is pretty impactful to me. They were asking him how he made it through, and he said... Well, I always knew I would make it out, and I don't remember what the other question was, but he ended up saying the optimists were the first to go, were the first to die, basically, and that doesn't sound right, but what he meant by the optimists was he was saying that the people there with him, the ones who said, oh, we'll get rescued tomorrow, oh, we'll make it out tomorrow, oh, it'll be better tomorrow, their hopes were always so high and then so dashed that they didn't make it. They couldn't bear how horrible it was because they wouldn't accept the reality of what was going on. Now, I would say that he was an optimist because he knew he was going to get out at some point, that the war was going to end and they were going to survive and be okay. But they also recognized, or he and those who were living like him also recognized that they had to deal with some pretty severe difficulties every day. And so their focus was, how are we going to deal with these difficulties instead of focusing on how can we pretend these difficulties aren't here? And I think that that's an important thing to recognize in the programming career, because day after day, what you will end up with every day is problems that make you feel challenged in the way that you say, I have no idea what's going on here. What are we going to do about it? And I have to be creative to come up with some solution to figure out what's going on and to keep us from losing, keep me from losing a job, or keep us from losing our company. Or they're often high stakes unless you are in a certain, you know, there are some positions that are less risky that are more of like, I know how to do my one thing and I'll do it over and over. But especially if you're in kind of the startup world, it's just challenge after challenge. And it's just like, you're a good friend with imposter syndrome, I guess, might be the right way to see that. And I think that the best way to cope with that is to be a realist optimist, somebody who actually accepts what the current situation is and understands that we have to, or understands that there has to be some action taken to cope with it, but knows that things are going to be all right in the end, you know, like has a determination that we're going to make it through despite the current hardships, and can find fun and optimism in what we're actually doing to deal with reality. So there's my sidetrack there about our work. But I don't know. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah. So from animation in the Pixar world, came out of that possibly, I guess maybe somewhat disappointed. I mean, you generally sound upbeat about everything, Murphy. So it's really hard to tell if something. But I can imagine 7 years of kind of, you know, wondering maybe you'll get to go back.
Well,
would have been pretty rough at times.
I can't tell you how many times I've actually had dreams about working there again. Not just daydreams, but right. I mean, like I wake up from a dream and I'm like, well, I was working there in my dreams. And we went and saw Cars 3 recently. Here, I'm bearing my soul to everyone who's listening, but here we go. We went and saw Cars 3 as a family, and I think it's a very good movie. It was a very well done and a well-told story, and it struck chords with me about my own life, and I was just sobbing as the credits rolled. And so, yeah, it has been a challenge for me emotionally to figure out what I'm doing, and I really want to do good things in the world that are good for other people. And I want to have fun while I'm doing it too. And so I've tried to be someone who's valuable where I am. And sometimes that doesn't always line up with what I think is happening or going to happen. And that's an interesting thing to try to deal with. But I think that we've all been directed. We all have great capabilities to do great good no matter where we are, I think.
Awesome. That's very, very inspiring, Murphy. So thanks. Coming then from the animation and some of those setbacks, and I really like the subtle undertone of, you know, you came across and started experiencing the web world and then had to learn about realistic optimism.
Yeah.
Maybe that should be the moniker for web development. You know, realistic optimism. It's what will get you through.
That's right.
So I'm supposing then now we're edging closer to the point at which you ran into Elm.
Yes.
You're getting closer to the front end, and Elm has somehow made its debut here
journey. You're keeping me on track. I keep getting off. So at Qwali, we did a whole lot of work really fast, and it was a massive amount of work for the time frame that we had. And we did a lot of it. We did it all in React, and we had a lot of neat ideas about how to go about solving the problems we were solving. And this was pre-Redux. And so we ended up making a lot of mistakes. We did our own kind of Redux alternative before Redux came out that wasn't super well designed the way we did it. And so we made a lot of mistakes and learned a lot from those mistakes. And I had actually seen Elm's website while I was at Space Monkey, the company before. So I don't know, a year and a half before that, I had seen Elm's website and thought it was just for games. It had come a long way since then, and it came up again at work, and I started looking at it again, and this time it kind of clicked. I got it, and I was fascinated. And I had been falling in love with functional programming because when we started at Qwali, one of the original engineers there was way into Haskell and said, hey, let's do this all in Haskell. We didn't end up going that route, but I did end up continuing to study Haskell to my regular depression, if that makes sense.
I was wondering which word you were going to use there.
Yeah, I would read about it, and then I would try to go do stuff in Haskell, and I would just feel really demotivated and depressed because I really wanted to learn the language, but it was so hard to do anything in it. And now it's kind of clicked. I mean, it's not a problem now, but then it was really a problem. So Elm seemed like something that was a little more approachable, and I spent a week of evenings with it. And in that time, I was able to make simple. I was using the simple program. This was before the Elm architecture was baked into the language. This was still when the language was separate. Yeah.
So 0.16 then?
I think it might have been 0.15.
Uh huh. Yep.
Yeah, I think it was 0.15 or maybe earlier. I'm not sure. But it was all signals, mailboxes, and then there was this library for the Elm application architecture called StartApp. And I used the basic beginner start app, and I was like, wow, I'm actually getting things done. This is amazing. And I signed up to give a talk at the local JavaScript meetup after one week of evenings doing Elm, and I talked about Elm. And it was like an hour-long talk. I just gave this whirlwind tour of here's how to make things, and I uploaded it to YouTube. I recorded it while I was there and ended up there. Hold on a second. There are like a large number of thousands of views. It's called Climbing into Elm, and I should probably link it in the show notes. But it ended up with 12. It has 12,000 views now, and that's 2 years old. But that's I think a testament to Elm, because after just 1 week, I was able to give a talk that a lot of people enjoyed with this, and so that was cool.
Very cool. So was that your first experience speaking public in like a technical setting, or had you had experience before?
Oh. That's a great question. I think I've always had too little embarrassment in the public sphere and embarrassed myself too many times. But even as I think I was 14 years old, I went to a conference called SIGGRAPH, an animation conference, on invitation from a guy who made a plugin for a piece of software who I was friends with, and he got me a free ticket and my whole family. So we got in, and I was actually too young to get on the floor. That's kind of a funny story, but I almost didn't get let into the conference until my mom said, he's here for this plugin. And they're like, I guess go into that one booth or something. And anyway, I went in, and the guy wasn't there, but he hadn't made it there yet, but his computer was there and his presentation time was coming up. And so my mom was like, well, Murphy can do the presentation. And I was like,
no way.
Okay. Yeah. So I threw on the headset and I demoed the plugin, and I was 14 years old, and people were walking by going like, well, who's this kid? Like, what's he demoing? And so like
did
I said,
did the actual speaker rock up at some point or afterwards?
Afterward, he came and we met him in person, because we hadn't met him before, and he was like, oh, hey. And then he said, oh, I covered your demo spot. He was like, great, thanks. And he was super nice, because it wasn't like a talk to tons of people. It was just on expo floor, right?
Like a stand. So,
right, and people were just walking by. It wasn't a big deal. But that's kind of like the first time I did tech speaking in front of people, and I've had too little embarrassment since then. That was the first time. And then I did a bunch of speaking at meetups, including the Elm one. And I've organized a couple of meetups, which always involves talking in front of people. So that's kind of been my experience with opening my mouth in front of strangers.
Very cool. And finally, we've come to the moment. Tell us the Elm Town origin story. Where did it start? How did it happen?
Yeah.
How did this thing? So maybe just to set some context for listeners, maybe not everyone's aware. The first episode for the Elm Town podcast was back in September of 2016. So we've actually gone past the 1 year anniversary, rather, of Elm Town, which is really awesome. I don't know, just little
That's
clap
right.
here for well done, Murphy.
We didn't do any celebration, so this is our celebration. Yeah. Thanks.
So that's
good
very
job,
cool. Man. We're well into the second year, and I think. Yeah, I think definitely the community really, really enjoys and appreciates the effort that you've been putting towards it. But yeah, tell us, how did the idea formulate? How did you come to start doing it? How did our lovely editor and producer Fergus get involved? How did that all come together?
Well, let's see. So I have been a podcast addict for a lot of years. I just love listening to good podcasts. And often when I would get interested in a new language, I would dive on and see if there was a podcast about it. And there wasn't one for Elm. And so I began to feel passionately about Elm and the stuff that it brought to the table. And so when I came to work at Day One, that I came to work as like the front end guy. Like, there was no front-end web team at that point. And so I had a lot of free leeway to choose what I was going to do. And I had gotten a talk accepted at ElmConf at that point that I had been preparing for months, because it was like a 6 months before you apply and get accepted. And so I went to do my first talk at ElmConf. And at that point, for day one, I was researching a bunch of different technologies. I wasn't sure that Elm was the right one to go with, because at that point I had been looking into PureScript and a bunch of stuff, and I had been worried that maybe Elm wasn't, it was too simple of a language for me to be able to do interesting and exciting things in. And so I had been doing some stuff in PureScript, and then also, like, our backend was in Scala. And so I was thinking, maybe I'll just do Scala.js with React. I had all these choices to go to choose from. So I went to ElmConf because I had this ticket to go speak. And I went and spoke and gave the demo, and I was blown away by the size of the community there, especially since I had been doing all this other stuff with some small, like, the PureScript community is significantly smaller than the Elm community as far as I perceive it, and the Scala.js community is very small compared. I mean, I would think just a few people who are doing it on their own and talking about it between themselves. But there wasn't really a whole lot of space for a noob like me in the Scala.js community to come in and get a ton of help. I felt like it was mostly really smart people who were just like, who are already super good at Scala applying themselves to the front end. Whereas Elm was a way, like, there was a path forward for people who were learning the whole trade and programming in general. So I arrived at the conference. I was amazed by how many people were there, and I really felt like there was strength in the community. And so I came back from the conference super energized about this, and I went into the server guys and said, "Guys, I think we're using Elm on the front end." And they said, "Okay." And so we chose to do it at that point, and I dove in. And it was right about that point as well when I felt like, you know, I'd really love to make a podcast about Elm, but I don't want to do a lot of work. So I'm going to just start this podcast. And my initial thought was, like, maybe I can get one person from the community, and, like, every week or something, we'll just chat, have an informal chat about what we've been doing, and I'll just upload it and we'll be done. And I don't remember exactly how it transformed from that, but it ended up turning into a show about the community. And I talked to my wife, and she came up with the name, well, how about Elmtown? And that kind of helped form the idea that it wasn't just a podcast about Elm, but it was about the community. And we weren't just going to, like, try to get impressive people to talk about their brilliance, but that everyone in the community had a place here to be talked to. And so that was neat, because it kind of gave a theme to the show of, our whole purpose is to highlight and build up the community members, because that's an extremely important part of a language, is the people who work for it and work with it. And so we did the first episode, and I contacted a few people, and we talked about a few things, and I, like, uploaded it right there. And like I said, I didn't want to do any work really. So I didn't edit it. There was no editing. And my whole plan the whole time was, hey, we'll never edit this. We'll just upload it. I think there were a couple things I tried to edit, and it was too hard. So I just sent it up, and it's been a lot of episodes now. I don't remember when the first episode was that Fergus joined, but at some point Fergus messaged me and he said, "Hey, I would," and I may have even asked, like, "If you want to help edit, then we'd love for your volunteering." But he said, "I've got a lot of experience in this because I do video production for a living, and I'm getting into programming on the side as my hobby and stuff I'm interested in. So I'm glad to edit the show." And I said, "Well, thank you so much." And from that point on, I started sending the shows over to him and getting great feedback from Fergus on, well, he would edit the show and make it sound good, but then he'd also be like, "Hey, you need to make sure that there's more quiet in the background for your guests," or like, "Hey, maybe you should guide this conversation toward these more interesting topics and compelling topics," because, I mean, he does interviewing and stuff and video production for a living. And so that's been really helpful to me to have Fergus's guide there, as well as his help in the background. That really wasn't as epic a story as I was expecting to tell, but there you go. That's kind of like the boring start to an Elmtown.
Not at all. That's very, very cool. I mean, the story more or less is being inspired by the amazing community and creating a podcast. You could have easily, I think, gone down the route, and I think that's why I personally find Elmtown so interesting, and I think a lot of other people do as well. It's a much more community kind of focused thing than what could have easily just been a very, very technically focused podcast. So I think that's really, really cool, and thank you for persisting with that, and thank you also to Fergus for volunteering to help out. I remember distinctly that there was a point where I think we could quite clearly hear, like, oh, yep, Murphy's got a proper mic now. He sounds, his radio voice has suddenly come through.
Now you can hear the very, dark, very cool. Deep tones.
All right, we are coming close to running out of time, but I do want to hear, and I'm sure lots of other people want to hear, that choice that you made all that time ago for Elm. How has it panned out for you guys at day one? Are you happy with it? Do you regret it? Challenges, excitement? Give us the rundown.
Well, that's great, because I'm used to making technology choices and regretting them later. Like that, kind of looking back and being like, oh.
Literalistic now. Optimism.
Yeah, we know all these hard things about this thing now, and it kind of like stinks. But as far as the choice to use Elm, I would not have made a different choice if I could go back now. It's been super to work with, and that worry that I had about simplicity being something that got in the way of making elegant code, I've felt the opposite. I've really felt like the design and simplicity of Elm has helped us write better software and be better programmers. So that's fantastic. There are some pain points. The pain points that we've had have mostly grown around trying to do private package sharing inside of our company, stuff that we don't want to publish to the package repo. That's a big pain right now, but it'll get better. And there are other things that other people worry about that we don't worry about so much right now, like bundle size, but mostly it's actually really just been the package repository woes that we've had. And the compiler speed has gotten to be more of a problem as we have gotten bigger projects. And so we've kind of put a band-aid on that by breaking up our project into smaller projects. And also I've done quite a bit more learning about like optimizing your file layout for compiler speed, which maybe we should do a show on at some other time. But I also get the feeling that that's going to be less of an issue once the next version of Elm comes out, because Evan's done a lot of work to optimize the compiler as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you give us maybe an idea, just roughly what kind of, I mean, significant lines of code is not by any means the best measure, but at least it gives us a kind of range, maybe with kind of sizes of what your various code bases are within day one, if you know.
That's off the top of your head. Hold on a second. Sing a song or something while I look it up.
While we have the time, there is no intro song to Elmtown. Maybe there should be one.
Yeah, we're working on that. Working on that. For a while we talked about it. I tried to get, someone said, hey, I can do like whistling and guitar, which is kind of exactly what I wanted to hear. And I said, yeah, awesome. And he said, okay, I'll have a stab at it, but never got around to it. So, yeah, we're still open, friends. If you can whistle and play the ukulele and come up with a nice little ditty, send it in, and we'll definitely look at that. So I don't
maybe
have
we should run a ditty competition. That would be cool. Submit your ditties, and then the community can vote.
Send your ditties to our Twitter account, and you will get highlighted. If we choose your ditty, we'll mention your name every time that we do it.
I'm suddenly worried there's a serious potential for this to become like a Bodie McBoke boatface kind of thing.
I would be okay with that. I mean, I personally love Bodie McBoatface. I think we should have stuck with that. So this is interesting. I just pulled up our day one web repository. Mm-hmm. 71% Elm, 12.5% TypeScript, 5.6% JavaScript, 4% CSS, 3% pure script, 3.6% that's code that I wrote that I don't actually use anymore that I haven't removed. And OCaml, 1.5%, other, 1.6%. So there's a layout of it for us.
It's definitely sounding like a seasoned web project. You know, it's been through stuff. It's got little cuts of starts of new technologies here and there. Okay, very cool. Murphy, I think we're probably coming up to time.
I think you're right.
Shall we do picks? Have you got some picks?
I do. I do have some picks. Yeah. And I guess I got to go first since I'm the guest, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so here's the first pick. First pick is something I've only been using for a day and a half called Scalar, which is, if you've ever used, Splunk. Splunk is a service for looking at your logs and graphing them and drawing inferences from them. We've been doing a lot of that kind of stuff recently, and I had a really hard time getting started with Splunk because the documentation was making my head spin, and so I just did a quick alternative search and found this really interesting service called Scalar, and S-C-A-L-Y-R, and they seem to have taken the Elk Stack, which is Elasticsearch, Logstash, and Kibana, and built all new stuff on top of it. I might be wrong about that. It seems to be actually, I'm going to scratch what I said about the Elk Stack, because it maybe seems Elk-inspired, but it's way more easy to use and excellent than the experiences I've had with Elk Stack. And I got it installed in like a couple of minutes. So I really had a neat experience with them since yesterday when I started working on that project. So I'm going to pick Scalar. The next thing I'm going to pick, which I should have picked first, is our Patreon. I don't know what the right pronunciation is there. But we have actually opened up a Patreon page for a parent company, which isn't actually a company, just a parent thing to Elmtown called Towncasts, because we've also started a podcast for Reasontown, and that's my third pick, called Reasontown. So the Reasontown is a podcast like Elmtown about the Reason ML language, and that is run by Towncasts, which is also me and Jared Forsyth, who's my co-host on Reasontown. And so our Patreon, that's where we have our sponsor, our bandwidth sponsors, sending in their support, and also there's a place there for community members to offer their support if you are a listener who's interested in showing your support. I'd be glad for you to go and offer some contribution on Patreon, and that would support both podcasts. And Reasontown is really neat. I've really been enjoying learning Reason, and we've been enjoying talking about it on Reasontown. So that's my third pick. How about
very
you?
Cool. I'm going to pass on the picks this week. No particular picks, but I would like to ask a question. Any chance that we're going to see Murphy this side of the world at Elm Europe this year?
Oh, that's a great question. So I have submitted a couple of proposals, and my wife has submitted a proposal too to give a talk about storytelling to non-technical people. But we do have two small children, and it's kind of hard to travel a long time with two small children. So we may end up retracting those talk proposals depending upon what we decide as a husband and wife couple. So there is a possibility, and there's also not the possibility depending on how we feel. So we'll see is the right response there.
Very cool. Okay. Well, hopefully we will see you over this side of the world, but if not, I'm sure we'll see you at ElmConf US as well later on in the year. But thank you, Murphy, for letting us have you on Elmtown.
I love it. And thank you for the interest and for this suggestion, Mario. I've really enjoyed talking too. Thanks.
Awesome. Well, that's all from us. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you later.
Bye, everyone.